This is edition number 1971 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 13th of June 2025. Hello and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just two items from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 4:30 in the morning and sets at around 9:20 in the evening. And the Mardler Annual General Meeting will be held on the Saturday, the 28th of June in the Methodist Hall, 26 White Hart Street, Aylsham, NR 11 6HG. Tea or coffee and cakes will be served from 10 a.m. with the meeting starting at 10:30. All Mardler listeners and volunteers are welcome. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 12th of June. I am Judith Elliott-Hunter and my fellow readers are...
Jane John,
Marilyn Evans
and Claire Hill.
The magazine supplement, which includes An Adventure with the Wildlife Trust, Norfolk Businesses 135 Years Ago, Age Really Does Not Matter and DIY Troubles. But first, council leaders refuse to rule out tip closures, figures reveal shocking scale of arson attacks, NHS boss claims almost half of the region's mental health inpatients don't need to be there. However, we lead with, it's actually good news, town reacts to its last bank closing. A coastal town is set to lose its last remaining bank branch. NatWest announced on Tuesday that it will be closing its Cromer and Lowestoft branches in response to a change in customers' demands. The Cromer branch, located on Church Street, will remain open until a new banking hub is in place. Tim Adams, leader of the North Norfolk District Council, acknowledged the bank closure marked a significant shift. He said, "It's obviously a big step to see your last bank branch go, but I do feel it's actually good news in disguise. Once the hub is up and running, it will increase access to banking services for residents and businesses. I've been to visit a banking hub in Acton in London, and just spending a couple of hours in there, you could see all sorts of different service users, from older residents through to the local bookmakers, so it really can provide for a range of different needs and be very versatile. Banking hubs are shared spaces operated by the Post Office and owned by Cash Access UK. They allow customers from a range of banks to carry out everyday banking services, including cash deposits and withdrawals, balance checks and bill payments. A representative from each bank, including NatWest, will also be available once a week to help with more specific inquiries. Eric Ward from West Runton said he felt unaffected by the branch closure as he predominantly used online banking services. However, not everyone was convinced. His wife, Brenda Ward, voiced concerns about over-reliance on technology. Banking hubs aren't the same as a proper bank. I'm against a cashless society. We're leaving ourselves wide open with all these hacking attacks taking place. The mayor of Cromer, Councillor Richard Leeds, said, "I am very sorry to see the NatWest branch bank based in Cromer is closing, and this could also mean the removal of their ATM. However, we hope that the banking hub will close the gap and enable other banks to have a presence on the high street again to ensure that we have some continuation of banking facilities within the town."
There are fears more of Norfolk's tips could shut after cash-strapped council leaders refuse to rule out future closures. Norfolk County Council needs to make £41.5 million of savings next year to balance the books, and leaders previously warned tough decisions could have to be made. From this month, recycling centres are no longer open on Wednesdays, and at a recent meeting of the Conservative-controlled Cabinet, senior councillors were asked about further closures. Liberal Democrat County Councillor Rob Colwell asked James Bensley, Cabinet Minister for Highways, Environment and Waste, if he could provide reassurance that further closures will not occur. Responding, Mr. Bensley did not rule out the possibility of further recycling centre closures. He said, "The County Council's recycling centre service is subject to ongoing refinements and improvements. Significant changes to the service, such as any further closures, would be subject to consultation before decisions are made." The controversial closure of Norfolk's recycling centres on Wednesdays will save County Hall more than £200,000. Wednesday openings at the Council's 13 full-time council-run recycling centres finished at the end of May. Six other centres already operated on a part-time basis and only open from Friday to Mondays. In another move to save cash, the Council last year introduced a booking system to take waste to tips and changed charges for tradespeople. In December 2023, the Council's Maton Wood Recycling Centre near Coltishall was closed in order to save £70,000. The decision, which sparked anger, came despite more than 90% of the 900 people who took part in the authorities' consultation over the closure saying the site should stay open. The County Council said usage had dropped off after the opening of the Norwich North Recycling Centre off the Northern Distributor Road. The Council has plans for new recycling centres at Wyndham, Sheringham, Long Stratton and North Walsham.
Firefighters have tackled more than 1,000 deliberately started blazes in Norfolk in the past 2 years, new figures have revealed. A former hospital, a leisure centre and farm buildings were among the properties torched in malicious attacks. Home Office data shows arson was the cause of a third of the 4,002 fires dealt with by Norfolk Fire and Rescue in the years up to December 2023 and December 2024. However, the number of deliberate fires continues a general downward trend over the past two decades, with the 1,095 in the past 2 years lower than half the number recorded in the single year 2002. Among the major malicious fires dealt with were the former St Andrew's Hospital in Thorpe St Andrew, which went up in flames in October 2023, and the listed former Victorian pumping station in Trouse, set ablaze the following month. A man was arrested after causing a major blaze at woodland near Wells next to the sea, while fire crews fought for 11 hours to tackle a huge straw fire at Stratton Strawless in August 2024, which closed the A140. Other buildings to have been hit include the former Oasis Leisure Centre site in Thorpe St Andrew, which suffered another arson attack, the fourth in as many years. The figures do not include the huge blaze at the former Van Dulf Shoe Factory in Norwich, which scores of fire crews fought in January this year. Norfolk Fire and Rescue said arson was a crime and should be reported to the police and could have tragic consequences. These incidents waste valuable emergency resources and put at risk public lives, said Deputy Chief Fire Officer Scott Norman. Fires led to two fatalities in 2023, while malicious blazes saw 24 people seriously injured, with 16 hospitalised, seven for severe burns. Last December, Pip Long, 54, was sentenced to an indefinite hospital order for arson with intent to endanger life after setting fire to a house on Hall Road, Norwich, which then spread to three neighbouring properties. The figures show there were 59 deliberately started fires at dwellings, 89 on other buildings, 75 involving vehicles and 100 outdoors.
The region's troubled mental health trust has claimed almost half of its inpatients don't need to be there as it unveils plans to finally end out-of-area placements. Bosses at the Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation have claimed that 48% of people currently receiving care in hospital settings have been placed there without need. Stuart Gee, Chief Transformational Officer at the Trust, said this had, in turn, resulted in more than 30 patients being treated either away from the region or in the private sector locally. The claims come as the embattled organisation has vowed, again, to finally put an end to inappropriate out-of-area treatments. The Trust has long held the ambition of ensuring no patient has to be treated away from the region unless there is strong reason to do so, such as students living in the area who can be treated closer to home. However, despite several past promises to end the practice, it continues to be an issue. As of this week, 31 patients were classified as receiving inappropriate out-of-area care, in some cases away from their family and local support networks. This occurs when a patient is not suitable to receive treatment in the community, but there is not an appropriate bed available for them locally. The embattled Trust has long faced calls to end the controversial practice, and bosses have made repeated pledges to do so over the years. But now it has unveiled its latest plans to do this, with bosses vowing to have no patients receiving inappropriate out-of-area care by October. They say the problem has largely been caused by people receiving inpatient care who do not necessarily need it. Speaking at a meeting of the Trust's Board of Directors, Mr. Gee said, "We have got a huge amount of work going on in that particular area to try and reduce that situation. One of the things we have done is just conducted a bed census that is showing 48% of our patients in our beds are considered to be inappropriately placed by clinical teams. This means they could be managed in a less restrictive environment. That could be at home with help from the crisis team or in the community, but we've got them in the wrong place at the moment. As a result, this could see patients hastily discharged into the community and those treated out of area brought back to the region." Mr. Gee added, "There are a number of things lining up now, and I think over the coming months they'll come into train and we'll start to see that movement and those patients starting to be repatriated back into the organisation." Caroline Donovan, Chief Executive of NSFT, went on to insist that figures relating to out-of-area placements include those in the private sector locally. She said, "There's a lot to say about this issue, but I think the first and most important from a service user and carer perspective is we need to be careful of the language. It is not out of area, it is out of trust, where people aren't being cared for within our service, they're being cared for in the private sector within Norfolk and Suffolk. Families aren't having to travel miles and miles, which in some areas of the country is the case. Significant progress has been made. Just after Christmas, we were over 40 placements out of place. We got them down to just over 20. Now they've gone up to just over 30. In the past, the organisation has faced fierce scrutiny over the distance some patients have been sent for treatment and for broken promises over plans to end it."
More than £680,000 in fines have been dished out to companies for Norfolk roadworks which overran or breached conditions. Norfolk County Council has released new figures which revealed that in 2024-25 it collected £345,000 in fines where roadworks overran by 1,317 days, the equivalent of more than 3.5 years. County Hall also issued 2,809 fixed penalty notices to companies which dug up roads without necessary permits or for breaching permit conditions, netting the authority a further £340,000. The fines range from £80 to £500, depending on the offence. The council is likely to collect even more fines next year as the government has decided to double the penalties. The charges for overrunning, imposed in 306 cases where work continued beyond the scheduled completion date, are also likely to increase. At present, the council can only apply fines on working days, but from January next year, the authority will also be able to charge firms for non-working days as well. The council, which is responsible for coordinating and managing roadworks, issued more than 44,000 street and roadwork permits last year, with utility companies and developers accounting for 75% of all works. 7,000 of the permits were for unplanned emergency works, which often create the most disruption, and 5,400 were rejected as the proposals were not acceptable. But Graham Plant, the Conservative-controlled Council's Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said, "With 74 different utility companies having the legal right to do work, the Council's powers were limited under national legislation." He said, "We are doing everything within our power to manage the impact of roadworks on Norfolk's communities. But the reality is that we don't have the authority to stop or delay many of these works. Utility companies have a legal right to dig up our roads, and in emergency cases, they can start work before even notifying us. While this lack of control makes it incredibly difficult to protect residents from disruption, we do hold third parties to account and will issue fines and reject permits when we need to." The figures were released after a question submitted to the council's cabinet by Mike Sands, Labour County Councillor for Beauthorpe. Mr. Sands said, "Utility companies sometimes have to dig up roads to deal with an emergency and seek a traffic regulation order retrospectively. Whilst that is perfectly reasonable, it seems that they are then in less of a hurry to backfill and make good their repair, leaving the disruption caused to linger on much longer."
A new supermarket has taken a step forward after a high street chain submitted plans for its signage that reveal it will include a new outlet inside. The new Sainsbury's, which will take over the former Homebase site in Cromer's Holt Road, is expected to create around 80 jobs in the seaside town. New documents submitted to North Norfolk District Council regarding advertisement consent for a wide range of signage at the site have revealed that a new Argos branch is set to be located inside the supermarket. The plans include four illuminated fascia signs on the south elevation of the store, three totem signs for the car park and store entrance, and 24 smaller non-illuminated signs throughout the car park. The signage, Sainsbury says, is essential to guide customers safely around the site and make clear the store's layout. Currently, Cromer's standalone Argos store is based at Unit B, North Norfolk Retail Park on Holt Road. Sainsbury's is one of several major retailers converting former Homebase stores across the UK into new supermarkets. The Cromer site is one of 10 such conversions announced by the chain last year, but the move has not been without controversy. Rival supermarket Morrisons, which operates a store just 0.4 miles away, raised objections to the plans. It claimed the new supermarket would threaten its trade and could negatively impact the town's economy. Despite these concerns, North Norfolk District Council has already approved the structural changes needed to convert the site. The standard consultation expiry date has been set for June the 25th, and North Norfolk District Council is expected to make an internal decision by July the 30th.
An inquest has opened into the death of a kind, warm and generous man who died after a crash which happened when he was cycling through a Broads village. Alan Tedder, known to his loved ones as Albie, died on May the 31st at the age of 62. He had been admitted to the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital earlier that evening after being involved in a crash while cycling home from a pub in a neighbouring village. The incident happened on the A1062 at around 6:45 p.m, halfway between Ludham and Potter, near the junction with Fritton Lane. He was taken to hospital but died as a result of the injuries he suffered in the crash, which also involved a Nissan X-Trail. On Monday, an inquest into his death was opened by Yvonne Blake, Norfolk's area coroner. In a short hearing, the coroner said the provisional cause of his death was face and skull fractures due to a road traffic collision. It was also confirmed that he had been born in Aldershot, Hampshire, and lived in Ludham. His family had issued a tribute which said, "Albie was a genuinely kind, warm, and very generous member of our family, and he brightened the lives of everyone he met," they said. "He was also a highly valued member of the local community. He has left a huge void in our lives, and he will be sorely missed. We would appreciate some privacy at this time that is very challenging and difficult." Last week, Ludham Parish Council had deferred holding a discussion on the road safety out of respect to Mr. Tedder's family. The council said the decision was made due to the recent bereavement and it was felt to be inappropriate and disrespectful to the family to discuss safety on the road at this time. The overall parish council meeting did go ahead and focused on other matters on the agenda. The inquest hearing was adjourned.
Council leaders have defended their approach to plant 1 million trees in Norfolk, despite the disastrous death of thousands of saplings along the Norwich Northern Distributor Road. Norfolk County Council has announced it has planted more than 634,000 trees towards its target to get 1 million put in the ground. But political opponents have sought reassurances that the trees will fare better than those previously planted along the NDR on the edge of Norwich. Thousands of those trees perished and replacement saplings had to be planted, with the council blaming hot weather and difficulties in getting water to them next to a busy road. Paul Neal, Green County Councillor, raised the issue at a meeting of the Conservative-controlled Cabinet, where he said planting along the NDR had been a disaster, with the majority of trees dying because they had been planted at the wrong time. He asked for reassurances over monitoring for the 600,000 which have been subsequently planted through the Council's 1 Million Trees programme. James Bensley, the Council's Cabinet Member for Environment and Waste, said, "All planting on the Northern Distributor Road was carried out during the correct planting seasons spanning 4 years, as the NDR was completed in sections and it was all supervised by an experienced landscape architect. It was not possible to water the trees and shrubs due to the impracticalities of working alongside a high-speed dual carriageway, noting also a lack of water supply along the length of the project. It is not true to say that the majority died. Less than 30% died, and replacement planting has already been carried out, and the project landscaping is becoming increasingly established. Forestry Commission guidance, when providing grants to local authorities, acknowledges an expectation that up to 25% losses can be experienced. To assure members that as part of our 1 million trees programme, trees have been planted in the right place at the right time, and with the right care, a robust planting process has been followed. The Council's 1 Million Trees programme, launched in 2019, originally had a target to get 1 million planted by this year. But with the Council well short of that tally, which it blamed on the COVID pandemic, it dropped the 2025 target.
Investigations are underway after the body of a man in his 50s was recovered by a Norfolk lifeboat crew. Anthony Gribbins was pronounced dead at the RNLI lifeboat station in Wells next to the sea, having been taken there by the crew. An inquest into his death was opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court on Tuesday, June the 3rd. The short hearing confirmed that Mr. Gribbins, who worked as a lorry driver, had been born in Chester and lived in St. Helens, Merseyside. Joanna Thompson, Assistant Coroner for Norfolk, told the court the provisional cause of his death was given as multiple injuries due to immersion in water, alcohol consumption, ischemic heart disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease were also listed as contributory factors in his death. He was located by the crew after the alarm was raised that he was declared deceased at the station. He died on Wednesday, April the 23rd, on St George's Day, at the age of 52. The hearing was not given any details about how he came to be in the water. His inquest was adjourned until 10 a.m. on Friday, January the 2nd, 2026.
A new self-serve bakery has opened in a North Norfolk village. Former nurse Yvonne Crawford has launched Bonnie Bakes Cake Shed. After moving to Overstrand from Ireland 8 months ago, Yvonne wanted to take her hobby more seriously. The shed, which is located outside the house at 9 Coast Road, will be filled with a range of treats every day until stock runs out. With my background in nursing, baking has always been a hobby rather than a business, she said. Since moving to the area, I have decided to launch Bonnie Bakes and we'll see how it goes. People can come and browse the cake selection before paying for their chosen bakes by using the cash honesty box or scanning the QR code for card payment. Since launching on May the 25th, Yvonne has received really good feedback. It has been a great talking point with the neighbours, and people have come out to buy cake after seeing me on social media, she added. My partner Mark has been a very great support in setting up the business, and his daughters, Lily and Ella, have been helping me with all the social media.
The Norfolk Broads have been named as one of the UK's best underrated destinations. Condé Nast Traveller has shared a selection of the best spots which might not initially spring to mind for a getaway, but are worth a visit. Writers for the travel publication advise that the Norfolk spot is best for water babies and wildlife spotters. The magazine credited the county's coastal towns and villages, including Holcombe and Wells Next the Sea, but the Norfolk Broads received the most recognition. Head to the Broads for something even more peaceful, the author wrote. Here, there are more miles of waterway than in Venice. Hire a boat and explore from the creeks to see this corner of the county at its very best, keeping a keen eye out for rare bird life that call these waterways home. The Broads were ranked among Ullswater in the Lake District and Lynn Peninsula in Wales.
Thousands of pounds have been raised to help support the family of a mother of three who died earlier this year after a crash with a concrete mixer lorry. Laura Akinuran Sharp, 46, died from a traumatic head injury following the incident in Brampton near Elsham on March the 24th. An inquest opening at Norfolk Coroner's Court heard she worked as a carer and lived in the Marcross area of Norwich. Her family paid tribute, describing her as an amazing mother, daughter, wife, sister and friend, and above all, a beautiful soul. Following her death, a fundraiser was set up by Mark Little, a colleague of Mrs. Akinuran Sharp's husband. He said Laura leaves behind her husband Israel and their three children, who are now faced with the unimaginable loss of their beloved wife and mother. In this difficult time, let's help support Israel and their three children as they navigate through this heartbreaking tragedy. In just 2 weeks, almost 50 people have donated a total of £2,275 in support.
More than £500 worth of Lego products were stolen from an independent toy shop. Starlings was founded in 1912 and has several stores across Norfolk, Suffolk and Lincolnshire. Bosses took to social media on Saturday night to report a theft which occurred in the branch at Holt's High Street. They shared a series of still CCTV images which appear to show a man and a woman stuffing a large Lego set beneath the woman's coat. The caption said, "If anyone knows these two delightful people, please get in touch." They helped themselves to over £500 worth of Lego products from our Holt store today. Please share this post to get it as far as possible to help us with identifying these two. The incident has been reported to the police.
A no-fishing zone could be widened on part of a Norfolk beach to make way for swimmers. Clyde Parish Council near Holt is keen to extend a swimming area on the village's beach. Its minutes add, improved signage is required, which states no fishing allowed in the swimming zone. As well as being a popular swimming spot, the 2-mile-long shingle beach is also a hotspot for fishing, as it offers a drop of into deep water close to shore. Anglers flock to Clyde each summer to fish for bass and mackerel, while the beach also offers flatfish and other species. The beach is also popular with birdwatchers, bordering the Norfolk Wildlife Trust's Clay Marshes Reserve. Parish councillors are due to discuss the proposals to extend the swimming area when they meet on Thursday.
The Spike Drivers are set to play their last local gig before retiring. The celebrated blues and Americana band, well known in North Norfolk, have decided to retire at the end of the year after an impressive 25-year career. This means the last chance for fans to see them live will be this summer when they perform in Northrop's Village Hall in a concert alongside Scott Butler, producer of Folk on the Pier. The gig on Saturday, July the 5th, will start at 8 p.m. with doors opening at 7:30 p.m. Known for their unique blend of slide guitar, rock solid bass and distinctive vocals, the Spike Drivers have been a notable presence at Cromer's Folk on the Pier Festival for the past 2 decades. The band consists of Ben Tysack, Constance Redgrave, Morris McElroy and Roger Nunn. Tickets for their final performance are available online at www.folkonthepier.co.uk/merchandise and cost £10. It is also noted they may be available on the door depending on availability.
A man seriously injured after an attack in North Norfolk is now out of hospital, police have confirmed. The man had been taken by air ambulance to Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge with serious injuries after being assaulted by another man in Church Street, Cromer. Police were called to the incident at 11:46 p.m. on Saturday, May the 10th. A spokesman for Norfolk Constabulary confirmed the man was now out of hospital and at home. They said inquiries into the incident were continuing. Following the incident, a man in his 30s was arrested on suspicion of assault and taken to Aylsham Police Investigating Centre for questioning. He has since been released on bail until August the 3rd. A road closure was in place in Church Street while police investigated the circumstances around the incident. The road was reopened the following afternoon, with taxi drivers in the area expressing their shock over the incident. Anyone with information is asked to get in touch with the police, quoting reference 36/32188/25.
A rare bird has caused a stir in a seaside village after being spotted at its mill pond. The black-crowned night heron, a bird more commonly found in wetland habitats across mainland Europe, Asia and Africa, was spotted in Munsley by Nadine Gray. A small member of the heron family, known for its hunched appearance, the bird is usually a rare visitor to the UK. They are most active at dusk and dawn when they hunt for fish and frogs. Mrs. Gray, who also captured photos of the bird, said, "It was only when my husband Googled it to identify it that we realised that they are hardly ever seen in the UK."
A brother and sister have appeared in court accused of trying to steal more than £100,000 from their late grandmother. Dean Morgan, 38, and Carly Morgan, 36, have both been charged with conspiracy to steal £105,091. Dean Morgan of No Fixed Abode and Carly Morgan of Leneve Road, Marsham, appeared in court on Friday for a plea and trial preparation hearing. Both defendants entered not guilty pleas. Recorder Ruth Brander fixed a trial for April the 26th, 2027. Both defendants were granted unconditional bail.
Footway resurfacing works are set to begin on Lynx Avenue, Cromer. The project, scheduled to commence on Monday, June the 16th, will involve the reconstruction of both sides of the footway, including vehicular accesses and the installation of new edging at the back of the footway. The work is expected to last around 13 weeks, operating from 7 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Due to the nature of the construction, Lynx Avenue and Queen's Road will be closed to through traffic.
A new radio station has begun broadcasting for the first time in Norfolk. Broadland Radio, the new home of beloved radio hosts Stephen Bumphrey and Rob Chandler, started broadcasting on Monday after making the switch from test broadcast to DAB. Managing Director Bob Norman has said that an immense amount of work has gone into getting the station broadcasting. "I'm overwhelmingly happy and positive with the product. I just think it's right," he said.
More salt marshes should be created in Norfolk, experts have said, after a landmark study found the landscape could be crucial in the fight against climate change and pollution. A probe by the World Wide Fund for Nature, WWF, has found the vast coastal wetlands on the North Norfolk coast and in the Wash act as significant carbon sinks. In response, the conservation charity estimates that 22,000 hectares of salt marsh should be created urgently, much of which could be made in Norfolk. WWF researchers believe this should be adopted as a government policy, offering a nature-based solution in its bid to reach net carbon zero emissions. Tom Brook, ocean conservation specialist at WWF, said, "The results are in, and mud matters. Salt marshes are powerful natural allies in the fight against climate change, storing carbon, protecting our coasts, and supporting rich biodiversity. As extreme weather and rising sea levels put more people and places at risk, the case for protecting and restoring these habitats has never been stronger. Salt marshes are not just ecologically important, but essential to building a resilient net zero future." A probe undertaken at a recently created salt marsh in Somerset found 18,000 tonnes of carbon over 4 years, the equivalent to carbon stored by 1 million new trees grown over a 10-year period. This is also the same amount of carbon as taking 32,900 cars off the road for a year. However, researchers have also warned salt marshes are under threat in certain parts of North Norfolk, like Stiffkey, due to rising sea levels, while in other areas, like the Wash, they are expanding. Mr. Brooks said, "While the initial data suggests some Norfolk salt marshes may not be keeping pace with sea level rise, the reasons behind this potential lag aren't yet fully understood. It could be due to reduced sediment supply, changes in tidal dynamics, or a combination of factors. What's clear from our report is that there's considerable regional variability. Some marshes are accreting, growing taller, faster than others." WWF says it will continue to monitor the situation over the coming years to better understand the factors affecting the health of salt marshes in places like Norfolk. The findings come at a critical time for nature sites, with environmentalists warning that planning reforms could leave sites at risk of pollution from the developers due to illegal protection being rolled back. Steph Acquaroni, Liberal Democrat MP for North Norfolk, has called for more to be done to protect salt marshes. He said, "Salt marshes are not only a unique habitat for several endangered species, which we're proud to host in significant numbers here in North Norfolk. They are also a vital carbon sink in our fight against climate change. Any report highlighting loss of UK salt marshes is extremely concerning. We are acutely aware of just how vulnerable these ecosystems are, not only to the pressures of expansion and development, but also to the escalating impacts of climate change. Annabel Hill, Senior Marine Project Officer at Norfolk Wildlife Trust, added, "Norfolk is home to large areas of salt marsh, including on our nature reserves at Clyde Marshes and Home Dunes, and is a hugely valuable habitat for wildlife and people too. As well as helping with much needed carbon storage, protecting our county's coast from flooding and offering a wild landscape enjoyed by so many, it is home to many wildlife species, including rare plants, brent grease and redshank. As our sea levels rise, we are sadly seeing the disappearance of coastal habitats, such as salt marsh, and it is vital that decision-making about the future of our landscape is led by this evidence. Working together to protect these special habitats is a win-win for nature and addressing the climate crisis."
The tragic loss of two young friends has moved a city man to launch a new scheme to help people struggling with their mental health. Gary Caswell, a carpenter by trade, has set up a project called Rise and Roam, which he is launching with an ambitious challenge this week. The registered community interest company is still in its infancy, but it aims to encourage people, particularly young men, to take part in physical activities together and build bonds through these. Mr. Caswell, 31, said he was inspired to set up the brand after seeing the heartache left when two young people he knew took their own lives. Niall Brown from Cromer died at the age of 19 in 2018, while Kai Mogg took his life in June 2023, aged just 18. Both teenagers were well known to Mr. Caswell, and their losses inspired him to look for ways of helping others who may be struggling. He said, "It is such a shame that people so young and so active can feel like they have no other option. What we're trying to do is create a brand promoting both physical and mental well-being. We want people, particularly young men, to feel like they have a safe place to talk and open up about their struggles." The project officially launches this week when Mr. Caswell, alongside friends Chris Dack, David Tye and Joel Pickford, will be walking from the Forum in Norwich to the London Eye. Once up and running, the company will fundraise to finance people to take part in similar challenges, during which they can connect with like-minded people and work through their worries together. Mr. Caswell from Thorpe Hamlet added, "Many men will be going through similar things, but just want to talk about it with their mates. Being able to meet people who have been through dark places themselves and pull through can make such a huge difference."
An 8-year-old RNLI supporter has raised more than £3,000 for the charity by using the power of his feet. Jonathan Jarvis completed a 60-mile walk from Haysborough to Hunstanton to raise money for the charity that saves lives at sea. He set off on Thursday, May the 28th, and completed the walk on Sunday, June the 1st. The youngster was accompanied by his parents, Lee and Kaylee, as well as family and supporters. He reached the Hunstanton RNLI station to cheers from the crowd that had gathered. Jonathan said, "The last mile was the best mile. I'm not sure what I'm going to do next year yet. I might see if I can walk a marathon in a day." He raised £3,150 for the RNLI last year by walking 42 miles. His dad, Lee, said, "He just got on with it, like he does, and enjoyed every mile of it. He was more worried about whether we were okay than himself." The family stopped at several lifeboat stations along the way. Lee said, "Every station we stopped at had some treats for him. The volunteers all came out in force to support him, which has been fantastic." The RNLI's visits and water safety lead, Kate Craven, told the crowd that the station's life-saving work and the work of more than 200 like it would not be possible without the kindness of those who donate to the RNLI. She presented Jonathan with a framed picture taken on his walk, along with a card signed by members of the Hunstanton crew. On his way, he stopped at Cromer RNLI station to meet the crew. Paul Watling, Cromer RNLI coxswain mechanic, said, "We all really enjoyed meeting Jonathan and his parents. He was so enthusiastic about everything we do, and his efforts are humbling for all of us at Cromer RNLI." His mother, Kaylee, said, "Jonathan has always loved the RNLI from being a toddler, as yellow was his favourite colour, and he got his first pair of RNLI welly boots as soon as he could. We are the proudest parents for his determination to do more and watching him thrive through his interaction with different RNLI volunteer crews is a pleasure." Proceeds from this year's walk, which was dubbed Jonathan's Journey on social media, are still being counted, but they are expected to beat the $3,150 Jonathan raised for the RNLI last year.
A wind farm developer has invested more than £2 million into community projects and education in schools across Norfolk. Equinor, the Danish energy company behind the Sheringham Shoal and Dudgeon wind farms off the North Norfolk coast, has supported hundreds of children, educators and vulnerable people through both its Sheringham Shoal Community Fund and Dudgeon STEM in Schools Fund. The Sheringham Shoal Fund is celebrating its 15th year and focusing on projects related to renewable energy, marine environmental safety and sustainability. The Dudgeon Fund, meanwhile, was set up 8 years ago and commits £100,000 a year to educational and skills initiatives for young people in Norfolk in the fields of science, technology, engineering and maths, STEM. A pot of more than £2 million has been distributed by the Norfolk Community Foundation so far. This year alone, the Dudgeon STEM in Schools Fund has reached 35 schools and 6,000 children throughout Norfolk, with 19 projects being funded over the past 2 years. Projects include the transformation of a groundsman's hut at Alderman Peel High School in Wells into an all-weather STEM shed, which has become home to the school's Kit Car Club, where students have built and worked on electric cars. The initial project led to students taking part in two electric car races at the Hethel Racetrack, where they went on to qualify for the Green Power Race Finals at Goodwood. Other Dudgeon-funded projects include a design and technology conference for 100 industry professionals and 300 students, a two-week student voyage with the Excelsior Trust, a boat-building club at Cliff Park, Ormiston High in Galston, virtual reality headsets for Litcham School in King's Lynn, and wind energy workshops delivered to hundreds of children at the Royal Norfolk Show. The Sheringham Shoal Fund has also contributed to hundreds of projects throughout its 15-year lifespan. It recently helped fund a new electric bus for North Norfolk Community Transport, which has given elderly and vulnerable people an opportunity to get out of their homes and connect with the outside world.
You are listening to edition number 1971 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 13th of June 2025. We have articles about a historic Norfolk estate changing hands, a boat builder's 25th anniversary, a Holt Care Homes gardening challenge, and 35 years of the Bure Valley Railway, plus the Mardler magazine supplement. But as there are no letters to the editor or obituaries this week, before that, we just have details of some What's On events.
Forthcoming events include: on Sunday the 15th, Father's Day at Houghton Hall Estate, 10:30 to 5, all fathers visit free. On Saturday the 21st, from 1 p.m, Ingham Village Hall 40th Anniversary Free Picnic and Social. Bring your own food, blanket and plates, and maybe a cake to share. On Sunday the 22nd, Catfield Fete at the Old Rectory, Catfield, 11 to 4.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. We include Norfolk businesses 135 years ago, It Doesn't Matter How Old You Are, and DIY Troubles. But first, a June adventure with the Wildlife Trust. Time is a funny thing, in that the same period of it, viewed through different lenses, can be both very short and very long. Held against the background of life on Earth, we humans have been around no time at all. The oldest unequivocal evidence of life on our peerless planet is 3.5 billion years old. Though single-celled organisms may have existed for many millions of years by that time. The very first hominins, the primate lineage to which we belong, appear in the fossil record within the last 7 million years, while our own genus, Homo, crops up a mere 2.8 million years ago. As for our own species, Homo sapiens, we appear only 300,000 years ago, Johnny-come-lately that we are. Accepting the most conservative estimate of life's origins, we humans have existed for just 0.0001% of life's trajectory on Earth. And yet, viewed a different way, 300,000 years is time enough to have fostered the whole glorious spectrum of human language, culture, prehistory, history, storytelling, music, technology, and medicine. What we have learned, created, and become in that brief period is astonishing. So time, viewed in different ways, can seem both long and short. One thing is sure, though, whether our 300,000 years here are short or long, our existence has taken a radical turn in the past 200 years. For the previous 300,000 years of human existence, every person knowingly derived every ounce of food, clothing, medicine, and water from the natural world, albeit often in the past few thousand years via intermediaries. We are inescapably a natural species, which, like every other, evolved to thrive in the natural world. But think about today. When you had your breakfast or made coffee, did you consider for one instant the soil in which the crops you ate and drank were grown? Did you reflect on the fungi and bacteria which enabled the basic physiology of the plants you consumed? Did you wonder about the clouds that brought the rain that was harvested by their tiny roots? Prior to the past 200 years, nobody on Earth would have eaten without ever having planted seeds in the soil. Nobody could have grown up not seeing a cow milked, a pig slaughtered, or a tree felled. Everybody knew from intimate experience that we too were, are, part of nature. But here we are, in our plastic-wrapped, mouse-click, AI-enhanced world, in which millions of our children have never seen a cow, let alone see one milked or slaughtered, in which millions of children have never picked a blackberry, played conkers, or grown a broad bean plant from seed, in which millions of children have never been given the birthright of a relationship with nature. At Norfolk Wildlife Trust, and across the partnership known as the Wildlife Trusts, we are in the business of giving nature back to children, all children, including middle-aged and elderly ones. We see it as fundamental to our mission and to our future that young people everywhere grow up and live surrounded by nature, loving and caring for it. We are aware, of course, that we can't turn back the clock. We can't uninvent smartphones, supermarkets, global trade, or modern medicine, nor would we wish to. We don't dream of some impractical utopia in which we all live in the woods in animal skins, but we work towards ensuring future generations of Norfolk people, and people everywhere can rediscover their ancestral essential relationship with the natural world. One of our secret weapons in this is 30 Days Wild. It's a campaign we run across the UK every year throughout the month of June. Yes, June, that's now, and you're just in time to sign up. All we ask is that every day in June, you consciously make time to do something wild and that you tell us about it via our website or on social media. Simple as that. How wild you go is wholly up to you. Go small. Have breakfast in the garden every day and make a note of all the birds you see. I'm sitting on a bench in my garden as I write, binoculars beside me, poised to lift them to a passing buzzard or a sparrowhawk. Go big, sow a native meadow in your garden, build 20 bat boxes and donate them to your nearest primary school. Arrange a moth-trapping evening for your village and astound your neighbours with the diversity of species living secretly beside them. The wild's the limit. With imagination, interest and minimal access to the outdoors, you can live your whole month wild, making time with friends and family every day to engage with nature, for your own sake and for the sake of all the creatures with which we share our lovely county. I feel duty-bound to report to you at this point that a handsome, chocolatey buzzard just flew over, as predicted, and that I raised my binoculars to have a look. Now linnets are chattering by, a herring gull is calling, but focus, Nicholas, I have an article to write. 30 Days Wild welcomes everybody. You don't have to be a Norfolk Wildlife Trust member or belong to a nature club. You don't have to spend any money. And you most emphatically don't have to know the names of plants or birds or insects. All it takes is an interest and understanding that, like every other living thing, we humans evolved in nature and belong to her. Refinding her can only make our lives more meaningful and beautiful. Refinding nature might just be the start of a wondrous journey of discovery for you, your children, your parents and your friends. Will you join us for this adventure through the month of June? Will you do one wild thing every day, however wild your heart decrees, and let us know? We will be thrilled to have you with us. And we're certain that you won't regret remembering that you, like everything, are wild. That article by Nick Aitchison appeared in the June 2025 issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, stories of Norfolk businesses 135 years ago. Made in Norfolk. There was a time when most of what we needed was provided by family-run businesses operating across the county and produced in the county. Today, we live in a very different and fast-changing world where much of our manufacturing base has disappeared and we rely on goods from other countries. It was a very different way of life 135 years ago. Norfolk 1890 was originally published by the British Publishing Company, a guide to leading commercial enterprises in our neck of the woods. Copies were rare, so the Norfolk Industrial Archaeological Society decided to produce a brilliant new edition edited by Philip Tolley in 2016. According to their research at the time, they printed and followed concise facts and figures. In those days, the area under cultivation in the county was estimated at 1,087,270 acres. There were around 63,200 horses, of which 45,000 were used for agricultural purposes. And in the same year, cattle numbered 118,500, of which 30,000 were cows and heifers. A considerable number of lean cows, shortly Irish shorthorns, were brought into Norfolk for winter grazing. It was estimated that there were more than 600,000 head of sheep and 112,000 pigs. Manufacturing was steaming ahead across the county. In Norwich, the boot and shoe industry took over from the manufacture of textiles. There was still silk and wool weaving in the city and at Yarmouth, North Walsham and Wyndham. There were flour mills across Norfolk, and agricultural machinery was made at King's Lynn, Norwich, Thetford, East Harling, North Walsham, Walsingham and East Dereham. Lime burning, malting, brewing, brickmaking and tanning was taking place in many communities, and in the city stood one of the most enterprising commercial operations in the land, Coleman and Co., along with so many pioneering factories making a huge range of goods. The Yarmouth herring fishery was famous across the world, with other principal ports at Lowestoft, King's Lynn, Burnham, Cromer and Wells. The train companies took passengers across the land and brought in many holidaymakers, while the wherries carried merchandise by water. The towns were full of family businesses, with regular deliveries, often by boys on bikes. Large factories were lit by gas, powered by steam engines, and used telegrams and a postal service with several deliveries a day. It was estimated that in 1881, around 444,749 people lived in the county, 229,483 women, and 215,266 men. That article by Derek James was from the EDP, published on the 15th of April, 2025.
And now, Brilliant Margaret proves it really doesn't matter how old you are. The day had to come. Last week, a charming young man on the busy London Underground offered me his seat. A kind gesture, one which I accepted, but I have to admit it was one which I was tempted to decline because I hoped I didn't look old enough to need it. Of course, from this lovely lad's point of view, his generation's angle, I did look old enough. It was good of him to consider it, even if in my own mind I'm actually 20 years younger. In America and Germany, some researchers, young no doubt, have been at it and come out stating the obvious, that the older we get, the younger we think we are when the dreaded term old age is applied to us. In other words, when you're 50, you think that 65 is the beginning of old age, but when you reach 70, you reckon that 75 is the dawn of decrepitude. It's all a bit bewildering, this research, perhaps it's my age, but out of all the figures, it seems that old age begins around 74. Well, if that's what the boffins say, so be it. It means that I'm not quite old enough, actually, to be old. I tried reading a report of this research, and I still found it odd that anyone could have come up with these arbitrary numbers. My dad seemed old at 70, but he did fight in the war, and from that time on, he was never very well. On the other hand, my mum lived to be a sprightly 88, and it was only in her last year that she seemed older. How we age depends on a number of factors. I'd say that genes have quite a part to play, and so does lifestyle. And then there's where you live and how well off you are or not. Poverty must be a significant issue affecting longevity. So, does it really matter, this age business? And why should we all be labelled anyway? It seems we can't help ourselves. We want to know how old people are and hope that if we're the same age as them, we look better than they do. How old do you think I am? It's the question that people of a certain age will ask, and of course, they're hoping you'll say that they are 20 years younger than they are. Being generous and diplomatic, we oblige by saying how marvellous they look for their age. And I'm no different. I want to be told the same thing too. In my line of work, in my telly days, you started looking over your shoulder in your late 30s. The odd wrinkle and a slightly altered figure could be frowned upon. I'd like to believe that those days are gone, but even now, off screen, I get remarks on the lines of, "Time you retired, love." It's not kind. We're all going to get older, but shouldn't we be allowed to try and keep going for as long as we can? Somebody who I've admired for a long time is Margaret Seaman. She's a Norfolk girl, now aged 95, and lately she's been enjoying some well-deserved praise for her knitting, not mittens or cardigans, but brilliant replicas of landmarks such as Buckingham Palace, Sandringham, Great Yarmouth's Golden Mile, and so on. I met her some time ago when her work was on show at the Forum in Norwich. She's a delightful person, telling me that she waited a long time to become famous. What a shame that one of the Sunday papers featuring her work couldn't respect her enough to use her full name, referring to her as Seaman throughout the item. I've noticed surnames creeping in more often into reports, as if everybody named is a ne'er-do-well. Margaret Seaman deserved better, having brought us such pleasure and helping to raise thousands for charity. The lady is an inspiration. That article by Helen McDermott appeared in the EDP on the 30th of April 2024.
And to finish this week's supplement, I may have a higher voice after DIY troubles with the loo seat. A recent incident at Fortress H reminded me of this old joke. All the toilets in a police station have been stolen. Police say they have nothing to go on. The Fortress loo wasn't stolen, but an attempt to upgrade it rendered it hazardous for males wishing to use the facilities. The loo was installed many years ago. It's one of those things that you use so often you take it for granted. But suddenly we noticed that the seat was showing signs of wear. Not surprising, bearing in mind the variety of posteriors descending on it over the decades. Some, no doubt, landing quite heavily, depending on the urgency of the visit. I was given the task of measuring the old seat while Mrs. H took up the search for a new one. She settled on one that was soft close. Now, we've never had one of those. Fortress H has always been manual. The opportunity to vacate the loo in style was quite appealing. The only thing in the way of having our luxury seat was me. My ability with a screwdriver is somewhat lacking. Things never seem to go right. If I'm removing something held in place by four screws, three will come out like a dream, but there is always one that won't budge. I end up screwing the head off. So with some trepidation, I prepared to install the new seat. I had to remove the old seat first. It wasn't the most pleasant of tasks, head thrust almost down the pan to undo the bolts, but I managed it. Carefully, I unpacked the new one and read the instructions several times. It didn't seem too difficult. To my and Mrs. H's amazement, I executed a successful installation without losing any of the fittings down the toilet. My reward was to be first to christen it. Proudly, I raised the seat in readiness to perform. Before I could do anything, the lid stayed up, but to my horror, the seat began gently to close. In the ensuing panic, and before my manhood was compromised, I managed to suspend operations. I realised with all my careful measuring, I hadn't taken into account that the cistern is slightly curved. Not much, but just enough to prevent the seat and lid going back far enough. Despite my efforts to adjust the fixings, there just wasn't enough flexibility. It's okay for Mrs. H, but for me, I had two choices. Sit down to go to the loo or perform some kind of acrobatics to hold the seat up while doing the business. I could, of course, put the old seat back, but in removing it, I hadn't worried too much about what bits came from where. When I retrieved it from the garage, I was confronted with a load of nuts, bolts, washers, and a couple of bits that had no apparent purpose. Mrs. H said it before I did. "You know, we really ought to replace that old toilet. Could you manage until then? If any men come round who need the loo, we'll just have to explain." Imagine that. "Do come in. We just warn you that if you go to the loo, you'll either have to sit down or hold up the lid. Don't worry, it is soft close, so if you let go, be quick, and you should have time to get out of the way and avoid amputation." So that's what we're going to do. Persevere with the current seat and replace the whole loo. Meanwhile, I will hone my toilet skills using two hands where I could do with three. But if you happen to bump into me in the street and you notice my voice is of a higher pitch, you'll know why. And that item by Nigel Haverson is taken from the EDP of the 12th of September 2024. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the EDP and Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our last selection of news and views. A country house in Norfolk has changed ownership for the first time in almost three centuries. Mannington Hall, a moated 15th century manor near Itchingham, has been passed from the Walpole family to new custodians, the Ellis family, who also recently acquired the neighbouring Walterton estate. A spokeswoman for the Mannington estate said, "After many decades of hard work and dedication, alongside her late husband, the Right Honourable the Lord Walpole, Lady Walpole has taken the difficult decision to retire from the day-to-day running of the Mannington estate. Much care has been taken in the selection of the best placed candidate to become custodian of this beautiful estate for the next 300 years. From March the 31st, Richard Ellis and his family officially took over the stewardship of the estate, with plans already underway to rejuvenate the historic site and continue the good work Lord and Lady Walpole have been doing for many years. The cafe has been refurbished and is now operated by Norfolk Bakery Bread Sauce. Renovations are also being carried out on the holiday cottages, along with essential maintenance to the lake and moat sluices. A long-term programme to refresh the estate's gardens and parkland is now being planned. Lady Walpole will continue to reside at Mannington Hall. Mannington was mentioned in the Domesday Book of 1086, and its hall was built in around 1460 for William Lumner. Known for its Gothic windows, motif chimneys and distinctive snapped flint facade, it was purchased in the mid-18th century by diplomat Horatio Walpole, the first Lord Walpole and brother of Sir Robert Walpole, who is widely regarded as Britain's first Prime Minister. The Walpole family, including the late Lord Walpole, who died in 2021, remained the owners until this year. Today, visitors can explore 20 acres of themed gardens, including a sensory garden, rose garden, and an enchanted children's trail. Nature lovers can enjoy lakes, meadows, a bird hide, and extensive countryside walks, as well as exhibitions in the stable gallery.
A Norfolk boat building company has celebrated its 25th anniversary. Neil Thompson established his company at the turn of the century. He started out with a small North Norfolk boatyard in Glanford before moving to Wells in 2017, where the company, Neil Thompson Boats, is based today. "We're immensely proud to get to where we are," Neil, who runs the business alongside his wife Richenda, said. "We've managed to build an amazing team, and it's a joy to come to work every day. We've built a great client base over the years. We're not just building boats and waving goodbye as they leave the door. It's more of a family thing where we keep in touch with our customers. The majority of our business is maintenance and servicing, so most of our clients come back and we often see them out sailing. We're looking forward to the next 25 years. Neil previously worked for Charlie Ward Traditional Boats in Mawston, where he helped to build Juno, a 45-foot, 7-berth Thames sailing barge. He set up Neil Thompson Boats shortly after completing the vessel, but continued to take on subcontracted work from Charlie. In 2007, Charlie wanted to retire from boat building after 46 years and offered Neil and Richenda the opportunity to buy his business. But they didn't have the funds to purchase the business, but they managed to raise the money by offering their customers the opportunity to pay up front for 3 years' boat servicing in return for a free service the following year. The couple bought the business from Charlie in 2008, taking over exclusive servicing of the Norfolk Range. The majority of the boats we build are shoal draft, designed for sailing in the shallower waters of the Norfolk coast and broads, Neil added. In recent years, we have started to build motor launches alongside sailing boats. Neil Thompson Boats employs a team of 8 people, including 2 apprentices.
A care home has turned a gardening challenge into a cheerful tribute. Heath Lodge in Holt, operated by Danforth Care Homes, needed a scarecrow to protect its vegetable patch and decided to create one in the likeness of a beloved team member. The vegetable patch is part of Danforth Care Homes' Ground to Plate scheme, run in partnership with celebrity chef Theo Michaels, and helps residents grow and enjoy their own produce. When birds began eyeing up the crops, residents built a scarecrow in the image of maintenance officer Kevin, dressed it in his usual clothes and topping it with a cutout of his face. Helen Horton, a 92-year-old resident, said, "I'm proud of our vegetable patch. I've taken responsibility for watering it at the weekend and I enjoy checking how things are growing. We all love to see Kevin around the home, so we thought it would be funny to turn him into a scarecrow. That way we could see him all the time and hopefully keep the birds away from our crops." Kevin was delighted by the gesture. He said, "It's certainly flattering, if a bit unexpected, to be turned into a scarecrow. If it helps our lovely residents in the garden and brings everyone a laugh, I'm happy to lend my likeness." The vegetable patch and its new guardian feature in the home's weekly cake and coffee afternoon, held every Wednesday from 2 p.m. The event is open to all and includes homemade treats, refreshments, and the chance to meet residents.
Back in 1990, I was the North Suffolk reporter for the East Anglian Daily Times, and one of the things we regularly reported on was the region's biggest theme park, Pleasurewood Hills in Lowestoft. That year, they contacted me to ask if I wanted to go to the opening of their new venture, a 9-mile miniature railway between Aylsham and Wroxham in Norfolk. It might have been out of our readership area, but I managed to persuade my editor that we had enough readers who would travel that far to a tourist attraction, so long as I did it on a day off. Now, 35 years on, the Bure Valley Railway has marked its big birthday with a special gala featuring the two locomotives that started it all, Samson and Winston Churchill. They spent 2 years on loan from the Romney Hythe and Dymchurch Railway in Kent to launch services. Since 1990, the railway has undergone several changes in ownership and no longer has any connection with the Lowestoft theme park. It also relies on volunteers as well as paid staff and has its own locomotives. Director David Lowe said, "It is wonderful to see the two original locomotives back for this weekend, and a lot of people have come to see them. But ours are bigger, the largest 15-inch gauge engines in the world, and most powerful. We need that. The Romney Hythe and Dymchurch is very flat. In railway terms, ours is rather up and down. The visitors can pull 6 of our carriages, but our engines can manage 10, which boosts capacity. On the opening day, there were technical problems which delayed the first train, but now there's a very professional operation attracting visitors from a large area during much of the year. Mr. Lowe said, "At the start, the traditional bucket and spade holiday makers were our main visitors. Very busy during the summer holidays and half terms, but not at other times. That's changed. Maybe not quite so busy at the height of summer, but many more visitors in the shoulder periods, spring and into the autumn. And because our carriages are closed and heated, we can run trains all through the year. Family visitors are probably still our main visitors, and train enthusiasts are very welcome and return time and again, but not a huge proportion of visitors. But the empty nester / silver surfer market is getting increasingly important. We get a lot of coach tours. Many people also combine a trip on our trains with a short cruise on the Broads from Wroxham." He said the fact that the rides could be enjoyed whatever the weather was crucial in attracting visitors. The Bure Valley has 5 steam locomotives which form the backbone of its services. 4 are usually available at any time. Wroxham Broad is currently reaching the end of a major overhaul and should be back in action later this year. It also has diesel locomotives and is currently testing a new zero emissions battery locomotive. The line is very accessible with good car parks at both Aylsham and Wroxham. Also, the Bure Valley's Wroxham terminus is next to the Greater Anglia station on the Bitton line, so you can easily reach it by a very different kind of train.
A Freedom of Information request has revealed how much money North Norfolk District Council made from its car parks in 2024. Figures show the council's 30 car parks generated a total of £2,740,448 last year, with Cromer and Sheringham leading the way as the district's biggest earners. The highest grossing car park was the 265-space Cromer Meadow, which brought in £395,543. It was followed by Sheringham Station Approach, £335,524, and Cromer Runton Road, £270,064. Cromer's 4 council-owned car parks made £870,164 overall, with August proving the town's most lucrative month, pulling in £169,627. July and September also saw takings of more than £100,000. The figures show Sheringham's 4 car parks generated £579,639 in total, while Holt's 3 brought in £318,503 in comparison. North Walsham's 4 car parks earned £120,517. The figures come just months after North Norfolk District Council approved changes to car park tariffs, with most new charges introduced in April this year. At resort locations like Cromer and Sheringham and also Fakenham, visitors are now paying up to 30 pence more, although in Munsley, charges were reduced by 10 pence after it was reclassified from a resort car park. According to North Norfolk District Council, running costs for the car parks are estimated to fall between £1.2 million and £1.5 million annually. Implementing the new pricing structure, which included new signage and advertising, cost the council £20,000. And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. And of course, if you have an iPhone, iPad or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the talking newspaper skill. But please, when returning the pouch and the memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was Julia Bloomfield, and the editor-producer was David Audley. and our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's cheerio!